name is John Malkin, and this is Transformation Highway. Today you'll hear an interview with Zen Buddhist teacher and author Zenju Earthlyn Manuel. Her latest book was published in February 2022 by Shambhala Publications, and it's titled The Shamanic Bones of Zen, Revealing the Ancestral Spirit and Mystical Heart of a Sacred Tradition. In the book, she writes that there are underlying esoteric, mystical, or shamanic histories to all spiritualities and religions, and there is no religion or spiritual community in the United States that is without systemic oppression. For many years, Zenju has practiced chanting, meditation, and sacred drumming, rituals, and ceremonies from the Native American Lakota, as well as voodoo from Dahomey, Africa. Zenju currently lives in New Mexico and leads the Still Breathing Zen Sangha. Here now is Zenju Earthlyn Manuel. I would love to hear about how you did come to Buddhism and then your discoveries about Zen and Buddhism. And obviously part of this book is about your awakening and realizing, you know, you're in the Zendo and you're realizing that these bells and the drums are similar to other bells and drums in your life. And I experienced Zen practice as a shamanic journey of the spirit. And part of that was having altered states of experience and visions. And you point out that those are not things that often people in Zen sit around and share. Oh, also, I mean, there comes a point where you're speaking with one of your Buddhist teachers and you say voodoo and Zen are the same, and the teacher, it doesn't really resonate for them. Tell me about that, coming to Buddhism and then discovering more about what Buddhism is for you.
Well, you know, I never was interested in Buddha or Buddhism. It never was something, you know, I'd hear people talk about it and I was like, the words didn't mean anything. And I met some people who were practicing in the Soka Gakkai Nichiren tradition. And at that time, that tradition was heavy into what they call shakabuku, which is to proselytize and introduce, well, they wouldn't say proselytize, so that's my word. They're introducing and inviting you to come to be a part of what they do. And so that's when I got in there, I wasn't sure if I had gotten into a cult or if I or what was happening. But I stayed there for 15 years, whether it was a cult or not. I stayed for 15 years and it was a great experience of learning shamatha, concentration, without a lot of Buddhist dogma. The readings were fascinating. That's when I started reading Buddhist teachings. And I was like, oh, because I would read books by this guy named Jack Kornfield, you know, I didn't know who he was, you know, but I would read and I go, wow, there are some people with a lot of wisdom, you know. Then I realized that it was Buddhist wisdom when I started reading Buddhist teachings. It wasn't these people that I was reading their books. And so I continued because I investigated that. Now, all along, even in the Nichiren tradition, I still found myself drawn and called to my own African cultural, probably I would say not even religious because I'm not from Africa, cultural traditions and customs. I have been to many ceremonies before I even came into Buddhism. So I was already there, but I didn't resonate or could find what they call a house where you're with a priest or priestess of a African practice, and the people that I practice African religion with were from Africa. So it was very different from what was happening in the Western world. And they went back to Africa, so I couldn't stay with them. Actually, they were invited me to come. I was 18 or 19. They invited me to come, but I wasn't there personally and ready to do that kind of thing. So then Buddhism, when I entered it, even chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo probably felt to me to be something very shamanic. In that, having this mantra, never had a mantra, and just chanting and watching my life change just from doing just that. So Zen happened really in a weird way to me, how I got into Zen. I have been doing silent meditation on my own out in Olima to the Vedanta Center. I would go out there. I don't know if you know about that center. And I loved it. I would go out there and I would pass this place called Spirit Rock. I didn't know what it was. I would always go, okay. Every time I would pass, went, okay, whatever that is. And then a friend of mine invited me to the People of Color. It was a People of Color retreat. I didn't go. It didn't make sense to me, People of Color retreat. So I didn't go. And then because where I was, we were all people of color, so I didn't get it. You know, in Nichiren, we were all colored. my whole sangha was, you know, black women. So then I went to, they had African American retreat. I think it was in 2000 and probably 2002 or something like that. And I saw these two Zen teachers. They weren't teachers, actually. They were, now I know they weren't teachers, but then I thought they were. They were practitioners. And something about how they presented their talks was how they presented it, not what they said, because I don't know what they said. You know, they didn't say anything profound personally to me. But it's how they bow to their seat, they bow, how they set up on their seats, how they spoke, how they got down off their seat. Everything was like, I said, yeah, I want that. I want that. And so I ended up checking out Berkeley Zen Center. When I got there, they said, well, there's a people of color group over at San Francisco Zen Center. And I was like, I'm not getting it. What's a people of color group? And so, this is number two. It's happening again. What's this people of color thing? Because in Nichiren, we don't have that. So like, we didn't. They may have it now. I don't know. I'm like, okay. And so they kept telling me about it. And I thought that they were trying to tell me to go there instead of be there at Berkeley Zen Center. So I did. I went to San Francisco Zen Center and joined the people of color group with a friend. And a friend wanted to go. She said, come on, go with me to San Francisco. So I was like, oh God, it's too far, but let's go. She ended up leaving Zen. I ended up going deeper into it. I ended up in a retreat, an intensive, and after that 3-week intensive, I just kept going. So I didn't feel like I made a decision to practice Zen. It just happened. Just like Nichiren just happened. Buddhism just happened. African religion just happened. Everything religious just happened to me. You know, Christianity, all of it just happened to me. And even my Sundance Lakota practice just happened to me. Somewhere down the road, you choose, you know, to stay. So I did choose to stay in those places. But Zen, when I got to Zen, and I did a 3-week intensive, which is modeled after the Tassajara Zen Center schedule, which I don't know if that's the same schedule they have now, but I'm pretty sure it is. But it was intense. They don't have a 3-week intensive anymore, which is too bad, because that is it was powerful for me, but I was ready for it. Most people would not be ready for that. I was ready for it because I had already spent 15 years in Buddhism. before I walked into that. And I did it, and I came out a different person. Now, what kind of different person? I don't know. It was just different. I felt at ease with my life. And I didn't feel like I had to change anything external to make it at ease. I just had to continue to practice. And it was every day. You know, you could go to Zen Center every day. All the other practices I had, you had to wait until there was some kind of ceremony or something special. But it was the only place you can go and practice in community every day, whether you like the community or not. You know, you practice every day. And that's what I wanted. I wanted something daily. And I did it. So I did go back to Berkeley Zen Center. I practiced every day there for many years. And then, you know, both San Francisco Zen Center and Berkeley Zen Center, both of the places. And just kept going and going and going. And then, like, wow, what happened to my life, you know? Where's my life?
It sounds like it is your life now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you say that voodoo and Zen are the same, or that there are shamanic roots to Zen that have been lost, you know, there's a whole part of your book that I suppose can be talked about in a few different ways, because it has social and political connections to it, but it is all about a spiritual practice. But you're pointing out that in the West, we have an anti-ritual attitude, which has to do with being anti-primal, primitive, indigenous, as if things that came before or were the origins of us need improving or should be controlled and dominated. I mean, part of you're pointing out that there is no religious tradition, institution, or spiritual community in the United States without systemic oppression. It is the soul by which we are given to dig out liberation every moment in an endless garden. And the anti-ritual voice in Zen, justified by teachings on emptiness, are a denouncement of indigenous peoples and shamanic ways of being. I just am curious to hear more about that from you, realizing this anti-ritual thing that is a part of the colonizing, dominating tendency. I like to believe it's only one tendency in humankind, and there's other tendencies, but it's been a strong tendency.
Yeah, so let me answer two things. So that about anti-ritual and then also the voodoo. So the voodoo situation, which I'm completely called to, because I think because I'm, you know, a descendant of Africans who were taken away, and most of us are, we're unable to fully practice our indigenous practices. You know, we don't know them, so we're further away. But I think there's some imprints in us that call us to particular, you know, African indigenous practice that have made it to some places, and some of it has been held. And for me, it has been voodoo. Voodoo means spirit. The word means spirit. In that when you're doing the rituals and practices, just like you are in Zen, you are discovering life, and you're discovering yourself, oneself. And that to me is the link between the two practices. So voodoo, it embraces all of life, just like Zen. It has the same principles as Zen. There's nothing different. What's different is the rituals and ceremonies and how you come to understand nature, how you come to understand life. And so a lot of the dances are about protection, upholding a good life, wholesome, about healing, you know, these kinds of things are these dances. But it's always made out that they're, you know, doing that voodoo is just something you do to hurt somebody or do something, you know, that has nothing to do with wellness. And it's just the opposite, right? And so it's very much, you know, like in to me, in that sense of Zen, where you really can't even put your hands on it. Like, what is it? So it's very similar in that way. That's why people don't know what it is. And people don't know what Zen is either. You know, so they have all these kind of ideas, you know, and I could tell that by things people would ask me to do. And I was like, I'm Zen, you know, they are, think I'm Vipassana, you know, so, but I'm not, I don't do insight meditation. I don't do mindfulness. I'm Zen. I do Zazen. And that's very, like, they don't get that. Like, what do you mean by that? And so, partly why I wrote the book, you know, to help out folks who did not understand it without saying a book on what is Zen, because you really can't ask that question. You can't answer that question, what is Zen? So I wouldn't write a book like that or an article or anything. If I did, it would be a poem. It still wouldn't tell you what it is. So anti-ritual. The anti-ritual speak and language began many, 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 many decades ago as part of the evolution of Buddhism. So there became a time when, you know, especially in Zen, where the teachers didn't want to do, to focus on or bring about ritual and ceremony. This is back in Japan, you know, to focus on ritual and ceremonies. My teacher, Zenkei Blanche, was that type of teacher where they call chanting and bell ringing and all that is there's too many trinkets going, too much going on, you know. So sometimes when she would take over a sesshin, you know, we all that stopped. No chanting, no bells, no nothing. It was just bowing, sitting, get up, sit down, get up, bow, 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 get, sit down. Nothing. There were no, you know, frills, you know, what's next. And so that was a moment, and I don't know if it's a name to that era, but if you read Griffith's work, who I quote, that they were this period where Zen was, there were a group of thinkers, I guess I would say a school of thought, where anti-ritual was part of really doing Zen in its purest sense. You know, how can you get it to be pure? You know, you let go of everything. So then there's this notion of anti-ritual in the way I'm using it, okay, because I have a little twist on it, right? And that twist is this, we're not going to do all of these rituals because I think, one, it didn't fit, right, into the American Western, in the minds, in the Western world to some people. Buddhism was coming about during the counterculture, you know, revolution. So it was like, here we come with this counterculture thing, and then we want to be able to do it without, you know, any trouble. So I think that on two ends, I think the people who brought it, some of the masters and teachers, I think maybe they didn't see, I'm not sure, that they should transmit everything, or they knew that that everything didn't fit, one or the other, you know. So I do say that we got the most important thing, because people say, well, if it wasn't transmitted, then what are we doing? And I think we did get the most important thing of each practice, whether it's Vipassana or whatever practice it is. We got the core, and the core was meditation. That's it. That's all it really is. And I spent a great amount of time in the book talking about Zazen, because everyone reads this book and then they get on the, I don't know if they read the book really, but they get on and question me and say, could you tell me what ritual to do to make myself happy? And I said, it's like Zen, you know, I have no other rituals for you, you know. So people it's just clashing in their minds. Everywhere I go, it's a clash. Like, are you talking about Zen, or, you know, they'll tell me about some ritual or something happened in their dreams, and that is not my interest. You know, somebody said, when are we going to do dream work? Shamanic bones of Zen. I don't know what else to say. You know, so, you know, I doesn't say dream work. I did talk about a dream, But it's not about dream work. I don't do dream work. I am a dreamer. I am a lucid dreamer. But it's, I can't talk about it. I don't know what to say about that. And I don't think all that I dream should be shared. I just had some really huge ones in the last week, like gigantic. And I have a person I talk to that's a diviner about them. So I could see, you know, to walk with it, because they're very deep. Some of them are too deep to, that people probably wouldn't want to hear it, especially the last one I just had. you were like, okay, I prefer not heard that one. You know, so I have some they're very descriptive and vivid and prophetic. And so it's not to be shared in a workshop or something. And I don't know how to help people do it. I think it comes natural to me, like it did to Buddha. Buddha was a lucid dreamer. All the teachings we had came from his dreams. And came from him sitting, not in his house at an altar, but on a tree out in the forest. Mm-hmm. You know, he was on quest all the time, always on a vision quest. And so I just feel that when we are like, ooh, I don't want to do a ritual. I don't like the word ritual. I don't like, you know, ceremony, that idea of that. I just do Zen. Then there is something in there. There's something in there, I think, when people say it, that they're disliking about something primal, some that seems very primal, uncivilized, all those things we do in the movies with indigenous cultures comes up. And that's what I'm asking people to stop and to look at that. It's interesting, none of that has come up in any of the talks I've had, that what we're talking about. And to me, that's one of the most important things. So I'm glad we're talking about it, because there's something that comes up in the mind that says, oh, you know, one guy said, oh, I hear you talking about all these different rituals, but Zen's focus is Zazen. And I say, yeah, the biggest ritual of them all. What happened in your mind in which you could not hold that Zazen is a ritual? Mm-hmm. Now, I'm quoting Tigan Layton. It's from his work. Zazen is a ritual, an enactment. It's his work. So I'm quoting people who already wrote this. I'm just putting it in a experiential perspective. Their page of endorsements are not in the book. They got left out. So all these Zen teachers who endorse this are not there. And so it's had a great effect. I think people think I'm just in my own vacuum. But I think that all Zen teachers that I talk to, and I talk to a lot of them, believe in this book, believe in the shamanic elements of Zen. I just think they couldn't figure out how to say that or transmit it. Mm-hmm. How would they say that? You know, how would they transmit? But I think if you begin to transmit, you don't have to use shamanic, you know, you can use something else. Mm-hmm. But if you begin to transmit the practice as an earth-based wisdom practice, of the earth, in which there are these elements involved in it, it's a better understanding than, up, it's time for Zazen, up, it's time for work practice, up, it's time for, you know, all of these things, like we're on some kind of schedule, like we're in prison or something, or, you know, some kind of, you know, it's not a schedule like that. It's actually moving from ritual to ritual within ceremony with each other every day. It's something different. If we could release our negative ideas about ritual and ceremony, I think we could begin to see. I only speak to Zen because that's the only practice I could speak to. I mean, it was in church too. There were rituals. It's shamanic. Eating a piece of cracker for the body of Jesus Christ, completely shamanic. And drinking grape juice for his blood, drinking his blood and eating of his body. Now, maybe in the old day, they would have done something different. The mystical Christians, I'm not talking about the, there's so many phases of Christianity, you know, but the mystical earth-based Christianity that there was, we probably really cleaned that one up real good. It's been cleaned. Even the Bible's been cleaned up. Yeah, so
right.
Cleaned up things we don't understand. We didn't understand.
This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org, broadcasting from the University of California at Santa Cruz. My name is John Malkin. This is Transformation Highway. You're listening to an interview with Zen Buddhist teacher and author Zenju Earthlin Manuel. Her new book was published in February by Shambhala Publications and is titled The Shamanic Bones of Zen, Revealing the Ancestral Spirit and Mystical Heart of a Sacred Tradition. Here again is Zenju Earthlin Manuel. There's another sentence or paragraph in your book that hones in on what you're talking about too. Beginning very early in the colonial era, there have been violent efforts, including the annihilation of African and Native American medicine people and the burning of those accused as witches to suppress that which was viewed as magic. This element of your book is really important to me. I'm also a meditator, and I gravitated towards Vipassana 30 years ago. So that's where I'm at. And and I'm a political activist. And so I'm always exploring this relationship of my inner world and the outer world. And a year and a half ago, I was stunned by the pandemic, and then stunned by hearing more people than ever around the world saying, we want to go back to normal and not the normal we had. We need to reinvent pretty much every social institution, spiritual institution we have. We need to reinvent them. And I'm just still curious about all of that and how it is we got here where people are educated to believe in this domination and control, parentheses, anti-ritual thing, which an important part of that to me is somehow we're taught to believe that direct experience is a sidebar thing. We should trust authority and hierarchy. You're talking about this in the book, that trouble comes when forms, and in Zen, maybe in Buddhism generally, there's this thing about the difference between symbols, forms, and direct experience. You're saying trouble comes when forms are used to establish authority and hierarchy that results in us not trusting nature, indigenous, ritual, all of that. That's all really important to me. I don't know what you want to say more about any of that.
Okay, so you said a few things. I'm trying to hold on to all of them as much as I can. The first one you're saying was really interesting, so let's see if I can get back to that. Was sort of the political and social ramifications of not respecting, I think, indigenous, ritual, not understanding it, and how it, not understanding it or respecting it, can lead to some horrific experiences like a genocide and massacre and slavery and things like this of people. And then you went on to talk about we were hoping things didn't go back after the pandemic of 2020, COVID-19, that we didn't go back, that we wouldn't, and there was no way for us to go back, and we didn't go back. Now, the structure, what's happening now is that the structures are still there, and they're still crumbling, and we're still trying to fit ourselves back into the structures, but we ourselves have changed. And I mean, some people have quit their jobs, there's a lack of maybe nurses and doctors, and things have changed, and we're working in these structures that are still standing because we didn't build anything new. We were busy being scared of dying. But things have changed inside the people, from toddlers who are now fearful of dying of COVID. They're only 4 or 5 years old, you know, to, you know, grown older people having the same fear, you know, because we're all in on a, we all did get into the same gateway. We entered that same gateway of illness and death, and no matter what age. And so just being human. So we did enter that. Now we're in this place that we're still alive, but the structures don't quite fit, and we don't know what to do with that. And I think over time, things will begin to show itself. We have to take the time to be in the darkness, but we keep trying to go to the light, which is my next book coming out in March 2023, called Opening to Darkness, Eight Gateways for Being with the Absence of Light in Unsettling Times. And so, because it's hard for us to be with darkness, we long for the light. And so it's mask on, mask off, mask on, mask, put your mask on, take your mask off, put your, okay, we have to wear our mask, period. You know, it's, this is ongoing. This is the new thing. Put your mask on, especially when you don't feel well. Even if you have a cold, put your mask on. You know, this is new. Not, it doesn't matter if you had a shot or you had COVID or whatever, put your mask on if you're not feeling well. Try to protect others. You know, that should be a new way of being. You know, find a mask that you're comfortable with, you know, but try to do your best. And then what does that mean to be masked and all those kinds of things? We're going to learn all of this. This is something we're learning, and it's transitional. You know, everything's transitional. Now, the last thing you're talking about, let's see, you said something about the political pandemic.
Yeah. One thing is about direct experience, and that having been replaced or pushed on whole cultures of trust this priest or
this
politician to run your life for you.
Right. And so we're definitely, I'm learning, you know, in the pandemic, I learned that I really had to begin to start trusting myself. So I don't trust the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. I no longer trust them. I do, you know, I listen. So I may take a shot, you know, take the vaccine, but I still listen. You know, I'm still listening to see if what they say is what I'm going to do. Right. You know, I have to, and everyone's doing that. So some people are deciding no, some people are deciding yes, and some people not listening at all. So, you know, this is typical of human beings, you know, but I think in all the ceremonies I've been in, Zen, African, Native, Lakota, that oftentimes we think the position, especially, you know, the position, especially the head, the chief, the abbot, the abbess, the teachers, the Dharma teachers, you know, wearing the robes, and, you know, all of these people, you know, are of wisdom. And then we find out, oh no, they're just like people. She made me mad. She made me cry. She made me do, you know, do something. I mean, you know, they, whatever, you know, these things happen. They called me a name. They were racist. They were sexist. They were homophobic. All of these things that people are, they were, because they're people, right? Everybody's a person. The people are in those places. This is the way I see it at all the ceremonies. The people who are in those places are there to guide you through the ceremony and through that alone. My teacher could not teach me how not to internalize oppression. She could only guide me. It's not her life. She could only guide me through the ceremonies. And this is why I chose Zenke Blend Hartman, because she really enjoyed ritual and ceremony. I mean, she loved Zen Center. And I'm like, okay, you know, I said, okay, I'll follow her because she is so happy. And she did transmit that joy to me. Because I get really happy when it's ceremony time. I said, oh, darn it. I mean, I'm happy too now. You know, every time there's a ceremony, it's just so exciting. Everyone is. You can feel the excitement. Some people don't like it. I mean, but those who do, you kind of resonate with the ones who are excited. Some people go, here we go again. You can feel, they're like, I don't want to do this. I'm tired of this. Who cares? You can feel that in some people. But I just get excited. I'm ready for it because I know in those ceremonial moments, there is an opportunity to see oneself in without words being said, without your mind running in meditation, you know, that you can physically with movement find medicine. Like you're almost like digging in the ceremony, like digging in the garden of life to find that one plant that's for you, you know, and that's the way it feels. And it's up to you to find it. You standing there waiting for the high teacher and the high chief to point it out to you. It might be the wrong thing. They might point, yeah, you go over there, and you go over there and go, you know, over there, So you really got to be, you know, sensitized, so using all of your senses, your whole sensory system, to in order to bring wisdom like Buddha did, you know. So it's not, you know, just waiting for somebody. They're just guides. The people who are leading, they're in that position because they have learned how to do the ceremony. That's all. That's it. And when we go and get interviews from these teachers, you know, or practice discussions, they can't tell you who to marry or whether you should have a baby or not. They really can't. You know, they can't tell you what to do if someone, you know, said something racist or sexist to you. They can't. They can't do that. That's not their job. What they can do is stand up and lead you through a ceremony for you to find that answer, for your own wisdom to come through. You know, if they're just, they can't, that would, if a teacher tells you what to do, I would run. I would go the other way. But if they're there to help guide you, you know, like point you back to that cushion, you know, eventually, because that's the only way it's going to happen. You know, so you sit at the cushion so you can become open. So when the ritual happens, you're like this. So by the time we're chanting and bowing, we've already set, right? So by the time you're chanting and bowing, you're like this, you're like the ocean. You're wide as the ocean. Anything can come through. Anything. In offering flowers or incense, anything can come through. And so for you, for your life, then you make the decision, not the CDC. But you make the decision from wisdom, not based on, you know, well, I'm not going to do it because I feel like they're forcing me to take a shot. That's not wisdom. That's just being a rebel. And you've been, you know, you're a rebel. You're always a rebel, you know, and you're proving it. And you rebel yourself right into your grave, or you won't. Who knows? You know, but, you know, that's, to me, the purpose of teachers. I see myself like that as a guide. Sometimes I get frustrated because I get into that teacher mode where I want to transform their minds. And aren't you listening to what I have to say? You know, and I'm really frustrated on Zoom because I can't teach Zen talking about it. It's very frustrating. You know, I can't show them through my body where Zen is. You have to see Zen. You can't hear me talk about it. I can talk about it, as you see, forever. We could talk for 7 days straight, just like we're talking, you know, and nothing really happened. You might learn some new things, you know, or be stimulated, and I'll be stimulated, and we'll discover some things. But basically, when the Zoom meeting ends, back to whatever, you know, and but if you're bowing, and you're as open and wide as the ocean, it's just, to me, even if you get going to the next thing, it's so different. Whatever that next thing is feels so different. You know, like if you were going to have a conversation with someone, like I have to have a bunch of conversations later today, and they're already changing just by me talking to you a little bit, you know, just starting to change how I'm going to, that memory of the vastness of my practice is coming in. It's coming in as we speak, you know, So, you know, this is what we want, right? We want to be able to, our own wisdom to rise, not Buddha's wisdom. I tell people, I don't care what, if you could rattle off all the teachings, you know, all the paramitas, all the noble truth, the eightfold path, the three poisons, that I tell my students, I said, I'm not going to teach you that. They get so upset. I'm not teaching that. I said, if you want to learn those things, then you should. I think those are good. I'm a reader, so you can read about it. The five aggregates. I was very interested in the five aggregates. And I read that in every tradition. And I was interested in the five aggregates in relationship to oppression. Because the five aggregates are about how we are human beings, right? So I studied that, and I studied it, and I studied it, and I studied it. And is it in my work? It most definitely is, in the things that I'm writing. But I don't have to go, and here are the five aggregates. And you go, oh, not again. And then you read it, and so what? It has to be applied to life. If we all died ourselves, and we could hear while we were gone, where we can't, and all we heard was people mimicking what we said when we were alive, we would be like, no, no. So I don't think that that's what Buddha wanted, you know? I don't think necessarily he wanted us to sit either, necessarily. That's what he did, and it came to be a good path. You could do a lot of other things. I've gotten a lot of information by drumming. I'm a drummer. It's far from sitting, but it's concentrated. It's very concentrated. And the sounds and the rhythms open you up just as much as sitting. So it doesn't mean that stillness and quiet is the only way. But whatever that thing is that opens you, whatever that is, you have to find it. I always tell myself, I want to write a book, please don't be Buddhist, or, you know, stop being Buddhist, you know, let's just stop, let it go. You know, some person wrote, oh, I should check into Zen, you know, because I had written something, and I'm going, you don't need to go to Zen. I always want to say, don't do it. You don't have to do, I'm expressing and sharing with you, if you need your own experience, okay. But I'm expressing, a lot of other people have expressed it. You just see how it works in your life. You know, see how you can take that wisdom and find a path, a way to open. And if you can't, well, yeah, it doesn't have to be Zen. I liked Zen. I did go to Spirit Rock for a minute for Vipassana, but I was so used to ritual, it didn't fit. It's like, what are we doing here? You know, the talking was too much for me. I'm already a thinker, and you know, in many ways, like, you know, I like to reflect, I like to, you know, pontificate, I'm a philosopher, so, you know, the last thing I need is keep talking, you know, so just, I knew it was gonna be the best for me. I needed to bow. I needed to touch the earth, touch my forehead to the earth.
This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org. My name is John Malkin, and this is Transformation Highway. This ends part one of my interview with Zen Buddhist teacher and author Zenju Earthlyn Manuel. Her new book was published in February by Shambhala Publications. It's titled The Shamanic Bones of Zen, Revealing the Ancestral Spirit and Mystical Heart of a Sacred Tradition. You can listen to part two of this interview on the KZSC blog interview website.